Good afternoon. Today is March 3rd, 2016, and the Legislative Commission on Data Practices is called to order. Let's see. Very quickly, we would like to first take the first item on the agenda, which is the approval of the minutes from the December 1st meeting. I guess I should first make sure everybody was present and accounted for, because I know last time. was that? Thank you, Representative Lash. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion approved. All right. And we are, Senator Dibble is finishing up a brief meeting, and so he's going to join us to talk about the next agenda item. So we are going to start with public testimony. Mr. Heller is here, and he wants to talk to us for a few minutes, and he has provided some materials that are in your packet. And if there is additional public testimony, we'll cover that after the hearing. Welcome, Mr. Heller. And just to confirm, as you and I were speaking, Mr. Heller, we do have the complete packet that you have. It is in our packets.
Thank you, Chair and members of the Data Practice Commission. Come and testify today. My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. I ask that the record reflect that specifically. I guess we can start as far as I've been reviewing some of the documents online, frankly, and I've made a compiled a list. I compiled a list of documents as I review them so I can acquire and apply some of this process here, and currently about one half of them aren't fully accessible with a reader. I just want to make sure that we provide equal opportunity for the four types of print disabled learners that are blind, visually impaired, pre-readers, and non-readers. Did you find that at the American Printing House of the Blind? We always want to make sure that we reach out remove barriers for everybody to have an opportunity to speak or testify or however they want to express themselves. I you don't have the orange sheet, but I provided a sheet here from Jason. He's the senior assistant revisor. That's the orange sheet, but it's not orange for you, but it's electronic email. This is the first time it's became hopefully fully accessible, thanks to the help of...
Excuse me, Mr. Heller, if I may just direct members, in our packet, you see the NFL page, and then it's the backside of that.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I just wanted to clarify.
I had asked the LCC to make that fully accessible, because when it was sent to me, it was an HTML, but now I believe it's in a PDF, and many documents, just like your own currently from the last meeting, are in PDFs, which we'll read out loud. That's a functionality of Adobe software that individuals have to download or provide to, because it's the default. You have to access those documents with a PDF. It's my understanding. So that letter goes into how the legislature is working toward conformity on accessibility. Last year was the first year that JAWS would read the HTML pages that had struck through underlying language, probably one of the few places in the country that allows the blind and vision impaired to know that that's what's going on with those pages. And I greatly glad to see that they're working toward that. Yet transparency is not there yet. And there's a direct connection between transparency and accessibility, and if you can't search it, which means the image, it's not transparent. For those individuals that acquire information, enjoy it and provide the same service with ease and use. Frankly, and those are individuals that have print disabilities, and it's a functional issue regarding how content is provided, again, how they acquire information. on the backside, basically, I would like you to join the team of the National Football League because they adopted Minnesota Statute 16E03. And if transparency is about searchable, accessible documents, apparently the National Football League think it's relevant for even recreational things. Also, there's another document that I provided I think is relevant. Mr. Thiessen did a January 21st press release about transparency and accessibility. Last year, they got a D-minus from a watchdog group that are data practice people. And perhaps he mentioned something in that specific HTML webpage. Hopefully it's fully accessible, also in a PDF. Thanks again to LCC committee. Perhaps they're going to address this, maybe some sort of committee or something in the rules to address this, because currently the rules that govern this committee doesn't really get at the content accessibility. The accessibility that the watchdog group here addresses is timely. But it needs to be one additional element here that needs to be added into searchable. Again, it relates to National Football League policy or Minnesota Statute 16E03. Now, there's a letter also from John Lesh. Hopefully that's fully accessible in a PDF dated May 6, 2010. I think you'll find the word universal design for learning in there. And I'm very confident that the content that makes up or the system that makes up Minnesota Statute 16E03 relates specifically to, just like it says specifically in that statute, 508 of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, which makes content compatible and usable with readers. The other part of that is 2.0 Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, AA. Yet Jay Wyant, he's one of the officers at Minute, which fall under admin, recommends AAA of WCAG, which is frankly the highest level, which is gets into understandability, and understandability has to do with read out loud. Again, that specifically relates to the universal design for learning. It used to be for special ed, started in 85 at Harvard. Now they took new funding from the federal government last year. Now it's called aem.cas.org. And universal design now is for everybody. And that equates to the word opportunity. And now we can get in. I'm going to stop there, I guess. And now we're going to get into a few things regarding the camera piece, if you don't mind. And that has to do, I don't believe anywhere in your documents does it mention encryption or security of people, third parties, using this information, how they're going to secure it, because it's not to mention accessibility, because people that are going to be working in the workforce are going to need perhaps some sort of accommodation, and third-party vendors aren't required to even follow 508 like the federal government. So as we look ahead for the opportunities and equality for people to be employable in this industry too, is that, as far as I'm concerned, anybody who touches state money or federal money or frankly both need to be compliant at least to 508. Because if they added the word opportunity in the Higher Education Act in 2008 and the Workforce Innovation Act in 2014, what does the word opportunity all about regarding transparency and accessibility and engagement and everybody, again, having that the support they need? Because it's my understanding there's the two individuals that how they acquire information. It's oral silent, braille is silent, and so is sign language. If information can be provided orally, 92% of us are born that way, then maybe, and they don't enjoy it, and their reading don't develop, frankly, maybe we should open this up my suggestion is have a discussion or get back to me regarding that. I think that's a real relevant piece here, and then I would ask that LCC or state agencies would create a policy. They currently not have a policy, so how, I don't know how they can say they're improving accessibility or continue to improve it when not even the public knows about this. State agencies currently that are required to do this are not required, again, are not required to post a policy that this exists.
Mr. Heller, if I can ask you to summarize and wrap up, we're going to need to get on with the rest of the agenda. We appreciate your input here.
For compliance reasons, then, as far as I'm concerned, unless the documents are fully accessible for transparency reasons, and this committee is out of compliance regarding its own word, and they need to make those documents, and if they're state agencies, they need to go back and correct them, and that's my suggestion. I'm open to any questions. Anybody had any questions about this?
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for bringing these issues to the commission and sharing your perspective and your documentation here. Members, any questions or discussion at this time? Thank you for being here, Mr. Heller. We appreciate it. All right, we will get back to the agenda and the order of business. The next item is item 3, and it's an update on the legislative appropriation. I will just call members' attention. In your packet, we have the statute that established our commission, and Senator Dibble is going to give us an update on the work that his group has done on this issue.
Thank you.
Welcome, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It'll be brief because we did our work. Now it's your turn. So the short version is we did have a good meeting and conversation. Senator Limmer was there, and a few others were as well. I can't remember everyone who was there. And we couldn't really it was hard to winnow down and focus on exactly which items we wanted to receive special attention and focus. I think the general consensus of this group was that we would use those dollars to do a little more intensive research, either working with internal or external folks, and it was thought probably best to, rather than hiring someone, because then the dollars would disappear quickly, because there's just a lot of ancillary expenses that go with bringing staff on board, and that would diminish the dollars we have available. So using the dollars we have available to contract with one of the now three law firms, or excuse me, law schools in the state to work perhaps with a key faculty there, working with graduate students, and to perhaps really do some deep dive research on behalf of the commission, and then utilize that information. So the decision was that we would invite through a letter to the deans, to each of the law schools, a conversation that would ultimately result in a proposal to find some experts and some corresponding law students to do that work. And so we drafted that, and coincidentally, just a day or two later, after we drafted this letter that we would propose to be sent to each of the three deans, I ran across Dean Whitman out in the community and mentioned our interest in doing this, and he was extremely interested and very motivated, and says he has some folks over there at the University Law School who focus their academic attention on these sorts of things and would be very, very... he happens to be leaving to become president of a college out east in a few months, so we got to get him all the getting's good. I should also mention that we'd also talked about some of our existing staff developing a primer on best practices and giving all legislators policy guidance as they're developing legislation. We've had this conversation a number of times, and actually our staff has said they're already doing that. So I don't know if that product is yet available for our perusal or not, but it's being developed. So you don't even have to spend any money on that because they're doing that already. So we're happy about that.
With our gratitude.
Yes, with our gratitude. So House Research is putting together a policy document and a primer on data.
Well, thank you for, I think this was a great idea. Anybody else who was involved in these discussions want to add any part, anything to that? Any questions? So with that, you have a copy of the letter in the packet that was drafted, and unless there's objection, this would be sent jointly by me and Representative Scott to the deans. So without objection, we would go ahead and do that. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we want to put some sort of a deadline on ourselves as far as the follow-up date?
I think that's a very good idea.
Otherwise, session's going to start, and this is going to get
yes.
lost in the shuffle,
yes.
and we do need to take care of that.
Yep.
So I don't know if the letters have not been sent yet.
No, they
okay.
have not. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's say we follow up by a deadline of 2 weeks after they've been sent. That
sounds like
reasonable?
A great idea. We will add that into the 2 weeks after sent, and we'll get that sent right away.
Perfect.
So my office will coordinate with yours, and we'll get that done promptly. Okay?
Great.
All right. Good idea. I love the good ideas. All right. Any other comments on this particular agenda item? All right. Then moving on. Update on Real ID, agenda item 4. Obviously, this was something that we have talked about in some detail, and then when there was discussion about potentially having a special session, working groups were convened to specifically focus on this issue, among others. And those discussions continue, and so at this point I would like to ask Senator Dibble and Representative Scott, I know there's a meeting tomorrow, if you would maybe want to update us on where that stands and your thoughts on this process and anything we should be aware of or able to do. Representative Scott.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're meeting tomorrow at 10 o'clock. It's back over here. Which room are we in? Room 200. And we're going to be talking about, we'll have an actual bill that we're going to take up and discuss with the working group. Basically, the bill is a repealer of the 2009 legislation so that we can allow the department to explore Real ID compliance. And we also have a section in there on expedited rulemaking so that they can start working on that as well. A lot of driver's license rules and things that govern driver's licenses in the state of Minnesota are done by rule. They're not done by statute. And so that was one of the reasons we put the expedited rulemaking in there. So we'll be just discussing that with folks tomorrow on the working group. And our goal is to, you know, take it up the first week of session and kind of suspend the rules probably and get the repealer going so that the department can start exploring its options.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Dibble?
And I'll just add that this is what we look to as what we're calling Bill 1. A number of items that are still of concern and that we either do or don't have to do, but still there's a lot of concern out there about those things. You know, a lot of the issues that Senator Lemmer, for example, has raised is not dealt with in Bill 1, and others share those concerns. Then there's just some practical stuff that we have to contend with, you know, like the driver's license that doesn't expire, that's not in this bill. You know, we need to repeal that. And how are, you know, there's some questions about how we're going to pay for a lot of this stuff, and that's not dealt with. We have to deal with that in Bill 2 and deputy registrars. You know, that's a lot of issues there. We'll have to deal with those in Bill 2. But this is a good kind of get it all started. Allows us to enter into, allows DPS to start gathering the data, doing the research, the analysis, bring information back to us, and also enter into a conversation with the Department of Homeland Security, both to get that information legally and without breaking Minnesota law, and also begin the conversation about how we might get sooner rather than later a form of a waiver or extension so that people with their existing Minnesota driver's license can start accessing federal facilities and the like.
Okay. Senator Lemmer.
Just a question. The term rulemaking, giving rulemaking authority, are we giving the, in this proposal, are we giving the agency's rulemaking authority to go ahead with the full implementation of Real ID without legislative approval?
No. Representative Scott, would you like to address that?
Sure. No, there will be legislative approval.
Okay. And then the proposal, I haven't seen the proposal, so I've heard things. And so I was wondering, certainly I would support releasing the agencies so they can give us direction and advice. They are the experts in this type of thing. The reason why there was a forced pause that agencies not get involved is that we wanted to make sure that it didn't get shuffled off just to a rulemaking agency and lawmakers who are to be accountable to the public are not skipped over. And so that's why the law was written the way it was in 2009. And it seems to have worked. The legislature is clearly informed that there is an issue, and this newer generation of legislators now can start again and get a full airing of the issue. Does the proposal repeal the actual prohibition on Real ID, or are you allowing that to be taken up whenever the final bill is put together, and then there would be a repealer onto that?
Before I ask Representative Scott or Senator Dibble to address that specific question, I would like to just say for the record that in the meeting announcement for the working group meeting tomorrow, there is a link to the bill draft that exists. Am I correct? Yeah. So that is available for everybody to review. Would either one of you care to answer Senator Limmer's question about the proposal?
Sure.
Senator, Representative
Scott. What we're asking the department to do is the bill just lifts the moratorium so that they can investigate, and then they have to come back to the legislature and report their findings.
Okay. One other last question.
Lemmer.
Is there a sense of, I heard the word expedited in our discussion, is now that the federal government has made a blanket extension to 2018, are we working under any timely duress and the need for an expedited system expedited addressing this issue in the next 2.5 months?
Senator Dibble.
Kind of. It depends on what we decide is important as a state, as a legislature, in terms of policy. So we're aware that the aspect of Real ID that prevents people from getting onto airplanes without a Real ID compliant license won't go into effect, won't be implemented until 2018, and then kind of the final hammer, everyone has to absolutely have one in their pocket by October of 2020. So that means that if we're not issuing Real ID compliant licenses by October of this year, then anyone who's up for renewal subsequent to that time would have to go in for a renewal sooner than they would on their regular cycle. So that and regular rulemaking in terms of standard timelines is a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I think the goal is to find a way to speed up the rulemaking process. Expedited rulemaking, I'm not exactly sure what the timelines are that attach to it, and they may not be fast enough for this purpose, so that we may just have to accept that people will have to get a new driver's license sooner than their standard four-year renewal cycle. Yeah. But for sure we know if we go with the regular rulemaking process, and expedited rulemaking does provide for some level of public notice and input, but certainly not to the same level that regular rulemaking does. So that would be something we would be trading away if we do expedited rulemaking.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked the question about an expedited timetable is that I know a number of legislators have contacted our congressional delegation to see if they could create a bill to repeal a particular provision of the Real ID law that was passed in 2005. Since 2005, it has not been altered by Congress at all. And that one particular issue is the allowance or the authority granted by Congress to one government agency, Homeland Security, that director, whoever that director may be, can expand the function and purpose of the Real ID program at any time they choose based on their own consideration. And I think a number of members are a little bit concerned that now the representational branch of government has excused themselves and given that authority to a political appointee. And it doesn't matter what party is issuing that political appointment, but I think everyone, both liberal and conservative, a wide spectrum, are concerned about that kind of unilateral application to expansion of that program, and it could be done without any consideration by Congress or the states, for that matter. So we will be signing into a deal that we may not have control on once we agree to it. And the reason why the expedited process I'm concerned about is that I haven't heard that from congressional members to see if there's any appetite to write a bill to repeal that small provision in the law that gives everyone a little heartburn.
Okay. Thank you. Good points. It'd be worth seeing if there are any updates on that from our federal delegation. Senator Dibble.
We do make an attempt to address it, and I think that is in the draft of Bill 1 draft, right? Which is that provision that says, should that happen, should the director, is it director or secretary of Homeland, whatever it is, of Homeland Security do that, create some other purpose for Real ID, kind of by waving a magic wand, that purpose wouldn't be in effect in Minnesota until there's some form of review in Minnesota. It's weak tea. It's not great. It's an attempt, though, to acknowledge the problem.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, the only concern I have is that the federal government will treat us the same way that they're treating us now. They'll put their magic wand away and pull out their club and say that our citizens are not allowed to get on air travel. There's not a whole lot we can do about that. So the time to address it is now.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have been in communication with Congressman Emmer's office and thought that I had addressed the specific issue of just that portion, that purpose number 4 as in the actual law, and just saying, just address that. At least put in there that it has to have congressional approval. Mm-hmm. And there was some miscommunication, and he drafted a bill that was a complete repeal of Real ID, which I don't completely oppose, but I think it's a train that's already left the station.
Yeah.
So I've reiterated to him, let's do just that portion. So I'll be having another conversation.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, just a comment and a question. Subject to the issue that Senator Limmer and Representative Scott were just talking about insofar as the implementation of what might come in the future, I just wanted to comment that I don't have as much objection to expedited rulemaking authority as I do to general rulemaking authority. So my comment would be is that whatever rulemaking authority would be granted within this bill, which I candidly admit I have not yet read, my request would be to provide specific criteria, a specific assignment as to what rules they would be expected to enact. And my question then would be, did I understand correctly that insofar as rulemaking authority is concerned, those rules would come back to the legislature for legislative approval?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And the bill language as it stands right now for this first bill just allows for this expedited rulemaking just allows them to amend the current licensing rules to allow for real ID. So that's kind of the extent of the rulemaking at this point.
Senator Newman.
And Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that sounds to me like a pretty general assignment.
Okay.
I would just ask that you consider specifying some criteria as to specifically where you want them to go in terms of rulemaking authority and limit their ability, and put that language right in the statute. So that there isn't any question about what we are asking them to do. And again, the general rulemaking authority always gives me great concern. Not so much the expedited. I mean, we do have the ability to have public input. But once we give them general rulemaking authority, we have literally relinquished our ability and our authority to legislate what we want. And so my question is then, again, do you anticipate that the rules that are being considered under the expedited process, are they coming back to the legislature for legislative approval?
Representative Scott?
I don't know. We'll get back to you on that, on the language.
Fair.
Yep.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I think the answer to that at present and under the language of the bill is no, and it's a fair conversation, and I don't know exactly where I would fall down on whether those rules should come back to the legislature for approval or not. But if they don't, we need to understand that we slow down the process significantly. We wouldn't probably have that opportunity until next year. What we might be able to do is let them go into effect, but make them subject to some sort of ratification, some sort of later ratification. And, of course, there are no rules that we can't amend or pull back at any point in time anyways. I mean, there are no rules that are beyond our reach anyways. We can repeal and we can amend any rule as a legislature.
Senator Newman, did you have?
Madam Chair, and I agree with Senator Dibble, there are no rules that we can't pull back. It just becomes more difficult. The norm would be that the rules, be it in the regular rulemaking process or expedited, do not come back to the legislature. I candidly would like to see that, but the norm is, no, that doesn't happen. And assuming that this would be a normal situation where the rules are not going to come back to us, that simply heightens my concern as to the specific authority that we give within this bill, so that it is not general rulemaking authority. We literally are going to tell the agency what it is we want them to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Additional comments, members? All right. With that, we will move on to following up on the discussion regarding ex officio members. We talked about this briefly at the last meeting. And I will remind members that in statute, when we established this commission, we said that the commission may elect up to four former legislators. This is in subdivision 2 of 3.8843, up to four former legislators who have demonstrated an interest in or have a history of working in the areas of government data practices and personal data privacy to serve as non-voting members of the commission. These former legislators must not be registered lobbyists, et cetera. So, we expressed interest in doing that. I have gone back and checked. We had two former legislators who had volunteered to this commission in the past that they were interested in being involved, and they are still interested in being involved. We also looked. There's really not a precedent for this, for commissions to do this, and so we were hoping there was maybe some sort of template that we should use to follow a process, and that does not exist, so we get to sort of create our own. Representative Scott and I were speaking, a thought would be to basically post this as an option and make it publicly available that people can submit their names to this, and then we can certainly reach out to people if we think we know people who are interested, and then set a deadline and have a process by which we would elect, if we have more than four, you know, that we would somehow confirm elect out of the group that is there. I welcome anybody's suggestions and input on this process, and we'll get something together and get back to everybody with what you have. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was part of the Rules Committee, at least in the Senate, that talked about or brought up the subject of ex officio members. And like you said, this is a subject matter that we have never gone down before, kind of uncharted water. And I think at least the general attitude of the Rules Committee was that they were a little hesitant to advance this. They did, begrudgingly. But I think the point is that I don't think at least the Rules Committee, both political parties that were there, were showing a keen interest in wanting to do this, but they did make the exception because data privacy is such a specialized interest and very few legislators actually want to get into the depth of what data privacy can sometimes bring policymakers. And we realized at that very same time, just by coincidence, that there were very few retiring members of the legislature that knew much more about data privacy than the rank-and-file members. And we felt that we needed to have that type of expertise to at least get us started. Whether we continue this or not is probably for the legislature and the appropriate rules committees to decide in the future. But just for the record, I know that at least on behalf of most of the members of that Rules Committee, they were hesitant to make this a pattern for other task forces or other working groups beyond the data privacy subject area.
Thank you. That is very helpful history and perspective on this question. Additional thoughts, members? All right. Well, then we will... If everyone is in agreement, we will move forward with the process to post this, and I would encourage everybody to reach out, particularly to, as Senator Limmer has described, members who have a particular perspective on this issue to make sure that they are aware that, because you know, we all know you post things and not everybody is aware that it's
right,
posted.
Right.
So I would welcome your help, and I will work with Representative Scott on that as well. Okay? All right. Any additional conversation on that topic? All right. Seeing none, then we will turn back to public testimony. Do we have anybody in the audience? Mr. Ehlers, come on up. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, members, just a quick update on the issue that we dealt with here in December, the issue of body camera regulation and policy. At that meeting, we talked about how the existing Data Practices Act does cover law enforcement video and has for many years, and that it permits video capture on body cameras to be available to the public, and at the same time, it protects certain data related to specific identities, such as undercover officers, juvenile witnesses, and certain crime victims. And so there's that balance in the current law between transparency and certain privacy protections. And we also noted that last year there were two bills introduced in the legislature, one in the House, one in the Senate, that would roll back a lot of the access and transparency by making much, if not all, in certain cases, of this body camera video private data. And so the update I want to provide today really is in relation to what the City of Minneapolis has recently chosen to do, which is to make its body camera pilot program to be permanent. And so it's going to be starting in May, offering body cameras to all of its officers over the course of this year. And so they're really moving ahead under the current law. They're moving ahead underneath the existing law that provides a good deal of transparency. And so we think that's commendable for them to do that. I think it demonstrates that access to the public and body camera technology can coexist. So I wanted to highlight that. Now, we certainly think, as we mentioned last time, there's other regulatory issues, including this issue of consent. When is it legal and permissible to record using body cameras in private places? Those things still need to be ironed out. But in terms of the public access component, we think this move by Minneapolis was worth noting. So that's all I wanted to bring today.
Thank you for that update. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure, did you introduce yourself for the tape?
Thank you. I was just.
Oh, thank you very much. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
Great. Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Certainly.
Thank you for the catch. Additional questions or conversation on that, members? Mr. Neumeister?
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, my name is Rich Neumeister. This session, which is a very short session, is going to have a lot of privacy bills from various organizations, and a number of individuals are pushing privacy bills. I just want to encourage that one of the things that if you may see similar themes in some of those pieces of legislation, rather than have the momentum carry bad policy, which sometimes happens on privacy issues, that you exert your knowledge, your information that you have and that you have gathered as commission members, to share insight with your colleagues. As you know, one of the things that you have all indicated before in the past is that if there's themes in there, what are some things that we can do so generically where the legislature and the public, I know I'm one of those public that engage in issues for decades, sometimes it's the same thing, or years, that you're trying to resolve rather than to come to that. Some of the issues that are still important ones. As you know, the body camera is entering its basically second year. Many legislatures are across the country are still fighting that in their second and third years. LPR, it took 3 years here. The school privacy debate, which I see maybe have some momentum to it here in this legislative short session. Is that it entangles a lot with FERPA, the federal law. So it's important that when things start to move. So in summary, is you've developed some expertise among you as legislators. You've developed some whatever that I think that you can say to colleagues, either privately or collegially or whatever. From my view, this looks kind of complex. Granted, it's a good bill. Maybe. And I don't know what you decided about what to do with the money, whether or not you're going to have a staff person or whatever. But even in that development, that was towards your goal, it can be very helpful, again, for the broad experience and knowledge for 201 legislators, rather than as one of my volunteer community service volunteers who's done this for a while. You don't have to just rely on people of goodwill who are do a lot of this on their own or whatever. You can develop your own expertise. And it would be a great engagement from community-type folks and then folks like yourselves to help build better public policy. Thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last week, the Education Policy Committee in the House, we met and had an informational hearing on student data privacy. And one of the only testifier for state agencies was the Minnesota Department of Education. And a lot of information came out. And among the information that came out, it was revealed that, actually, let me back up a second. It's normal for state agencies to be sharing data. Whatever agency it is, they're collecting information. I think we had, at one point, Department of Transportation discussing how they're sharing driver's license data, et cetera, with third parties. And so that's a normal practice. And in that discussion, it's typical in the agreements that they come up with to say that the controls that the third party has in place must equal the controls that the agency has in order to protect the data in a like manner that the agency is doing. But then in that conversation regarding that, context, it was, well, what's your recourse? if there is a breach or something and the contract is not followed, what happens? Well, and the answer at that point was, we simply will continue to do business. We will no longer share in the future with that third party. Well, that doesn't do anything for the data that had already been shared and potentially breached. Mm-hmm. So in the conversation last week then, the same thing. They are sharing data, and I asked the question, are you auditing these third parties? There is similar language to ensure that data is protected in like manner, but are you auditing these third parties to ensure that they are protecting? And if there is a breach, what's the process to be notified, et cetera? And it came to light that MDE has been sharing information with third parties. They receive 30 to 40 applications per year in order to request to share. I didn't ask, or I don't recall the number of how many they actually share within on an annual basis, but if they receive 30 to 40 applications per year requesting to share, and what they said, in the last 10 years, they have not audited once any of the third parties, the controls that they have in place. So the scenario I put forth two scenarios. It's very common for, in the private sector or any place where there's computers, for companies or the organizations to have organization-issued flash drives, for example. And then those are required to be used. But then employees might bring in their personal flash drive for one reason or another. Maybe it's to back data up. Maybe it's to bring it home and work on it in the evenings. But when that happens, you have data being copied from organization or company assets to personal equipment, and there's no controls in place for that. Another example would be if one of these third parties had a laptop, one of the third parties that data had been shared with, MDE data, and it was on a company asset, but a laptop that did not have a hard drive that was encrypted. And then perhaps it was stolen out of the trunk of their car or the back seat of their SUV, et cetera. MDE, you know, because they're not auditing these third parties, would not be aware that there may be a laptop that was stolen that had did not have a hard drive that was encrypted, and therefore data potentially becomes vulnerable. So anyway, I say that because this is a reoccurring theme we've seen now with at least two state agencies, and I presume it's probably a commonplace, something that this commission should continue to look at, as that's been brought up before. The sharing of information with third parties and the controls that are in place for these third parties and or auditing of these third parties. So,
thank you. That is good information, and I know several of us are carrying bills regarding student privacy, and I can see an amendment in my future. Thank you. Additional comments, members? Any other public testimony? Mr. Heller?
This is Rick Heller.
And may I ask, is this additional?
Yeah, this is specific regarding the conversation today. Rick Heller and Fisher represent the twice exceptional print disabled. Just for the record, as I continue to look at rules, which is part of the SONAR process in Minnesota, to underwrite statutes, correct me if I'm wrong. However, currently the rules system in Minnesota and IPAD, the Information Policy Analysis Division of Minnesota, which is part of Data Practice 13, does not have to follow content accessibility law. If you provide rules for that process, likely the struck through underlying language that will be part of that process will not be fully accessible for the public. Chapter 13 does talk about electronic, but it never merged accessibility law, and I think it's a relevant piece, as if you try to move this into a SONAR for public hearing process, you might want to inquire about that, or perhaps somebody might want to write a bill or have Jay Wyatt or the two commissioners talk among themselves, since we're in the 21st century, and electronic needs to be more defined for the audience. Thank you for this time to talk.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Any additional public testimony today? All right, well, seeing none, thank you, members, for your time. We will get back to you on these issues we discussed, and everybody have a great start to your session. Today's meeting is adjourned.